bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook, NFL Week 13, Monday Night Football Edition. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. But before we get things rolling this fine Monday morning, want to encourage you, our loyal listeners, FanDuel.com/BetTheBoard. Take advantage of all of the great sign-up bonuses FanDuel's made available to you, whether it's a $1,000 risk-free bet, 30-1 enhanced odds available on tonight's showdown between Buffalo and New England. It's all right there at your fingertips in states where FanDuel is located. Payne,
30-1.
30-1, baby. Albeit some limits, but 30-1 if you don't have a strong opinion one way or another in tonight's game.
Yeah, feels like a game with some variance, so that might not be too bad to take advantage of. As always, link is in the podcast description.
You think we'll have 30 inches of snow on the ground in Western New York for this game? I know this is a contest where later in the show you get to play meteorologist, so all of our listeners are going to be extremely excited.
We're going to make them wait with bated breath until the breakdown.
As always, Monday mornings, we like to look back at everything we saw unfold during the course of the previous week. And Payne, I think the most logical place to start is obviously with Sunday Night Football and a drive that may go down as the Mona Lisa for underbettors that you tweeted about last evening.
How great was that?
Outstanding. Outstanding. You couldn't have drawn it up any better.
I really was hoping that Fangio said to himself, "Yeah, we're down a score. I'm a defensive guy. We're going to punt on 4th and 7. And then the drive just kept going, and he went for it, and Cortland Sutton, I believe, caught a ball, slipped, and then crawled over the first down marker to extend it. When we talked about our best bet last week, right there, I said there was only one game that we bet, but it's moved 2.5 points. That was that game. We went under 49.5 on Monday. Was down to, you know, 47, trending towards 46.5 at the time we gave out the best bet. And, you know, I'm not trying to give out numbers that have been crushed, especially through some keys there. And I didn't think 47 would last overly long. And I think it was pretty much wiped out by Friday morning. What unfolded is kind of what we expected, right? You have the style of defense that Vic Fangio plays that is given Kansas City some trouble. They have the cornerbacks that can match up pretty well. Got some of the front seven guys healthy again, right? It's a battle for first place in the division. And then you go on this methodical drive, which is exactly how we saw their offense playing out. They wanted to run the ball. It was a slow-paced team. They let the clock just wind all the way down, and they kind of rely on Teddy making some crucial third down throws, and we said that he wasn't 100% healthy. And you saw that big, looked like almost like an old school shin guard. It was like a phone book in his right shin. So he was banged up a little bit. And we've been talking for a while about the Chiefs' defensive improvements. And they were on full display again last night. And you had a situation where Kansas City's offense really wasn't pressed. Right? You come out, you score. The game never feels like it's in doubt, as crazy as that sounds, right? There was a situation where you go on that long drive, you could have got the momentum tying score before half, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're in a game. But that really wasn't the case. I mean, you were kind of down like double digits the whole time, and the offense for Denver was playing clock control, keeping Mahomes off the field, and there just wasn't this opportunity to have this massive explosion. When you go on an 11-minute drive, you like wiped out a quarter of football. We're talking about like three quarters of football at this point. And you know, you had some drops there. Mahomes wasn't overly efficient. But at the end of the day, as ugly as it was offensively for Kansas City once again, it just never felt like the game was in doubt.
I do want to ask about that because you've been ahead of the curve when it comes to Kansas City talking about their defensive improvements, and they've been markedly better over the last 5 or 6 weeks, obviously, in a variety of facets. Sure, they when you look at the raw yardage, the yard per carry stuff against Denver wasn't great, but to your point, when you're playing with a 2-touchdown lead, you're more than happy to let your opponent run the football. Another week has passed, and we know how great Andy Reid is making adjustments coming out of the bye, but you talked about the offense and Patrick Mahomes not being overly efficient. Do we still need to see that true breakout performance from Kansas City? Other than the blip against Vegas, it's been more of the same. I mean, Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill, 5 catches between them for just 49 yards. Mahomes' final stat line, 15 of 29, 184 yards and a pick. And Clyde Edwards-Helaire was efficient but not overly explosive as the leading back for the Chiefs in the ground game.
If this wasn't week 14, I probably wouldn't divulge any of this. But Patrick Mahomes is the face of the league, right? And so we talk about him every freaking week.
Yep, for sure.
No one's mentioned Josh Allen being terrible. No one's mentioned Lamar Jackson being terrible.
Oh, Lamar's been bad.
No one's mentioned
he's been awful.
Rodgers. No one's mentioning Aaron Rodgers, like regression. And what we are seeing is league-wide. We had this run where everything was, we need to be efficient passing teams. And all of a sudden, defenses have countered this. And now we're in the readjustment phase. And this is why last year, the first 5 weeks, our group was out ahead of everybody in this market. Not just because of the situation with no fans in the stands. And there was literally like a mandate to start that season that we expect sloppy football because camp was not extended. We're going to be very... we're not going to call a lot of holding penalties. And that's what we saw. And so like week one last year, the average opening total was 46. By week five, it was 51. I bet more overs in the first 5 weeks last year than I bet in my entire life. And you know that firsthand. I kept saying to you, you're like, what is going on here?
Trust me. I thought somebody had taken over your modeling. I thought somebody had taken over inside your head. I'm going, I'm not sure I even know who this guy is after all these years of working together in the space.
And because it's week 14, again, I'll divulge this. I probably shouldn't. And I will get yelled at here pretty soon, but our model this year, it's like nothing but unders. And it's because of this situation that we're seeing where all of these high-flying attacks are being defended differently. So was it a coming-out party against the Raiders? No, that's the offense, but that defense elected to play them the old way.
Yeah, gosh.
So the Chiefs' offense is still there if you're deciding to play them the old way. But this is different, right, in the sense that Mahomes sat on the bench for an entire freaking quarter during that drive, so the counting stats are not going to look great, right? And then you have a situation where you're up double digits the entire game. And so, again, it's not going to look great. And then was Mahomes accurate last night? No, he wasn't. He needs to be better. At the same time, Byron Pringle drops 2 balls in the first half. Tyreek Hill, if you heard the halftime reports, like Andy Reid was pissed about drops. Like, I can't, got to. And then Tyreek Hill comes out on the opening drive and drops 2 balls, one of which leads to a pick. So it's constantly like, it's everything. It's not just Mahomes. But there is this situation, right, that we're dealing with where the Chiefs are winning ugly. Thankfully, the defense has come around and we're still waiting for the offense to show up. But there's a lot of off-field stuff, too. Like, you know, how is Andy Reid, right, dealing with some health stuff? How is he dealing with his son's situation? Patrick Mahomes just became a father. Like, there are some things in life that are going on here with the Chiefs, and it's not necessarily just how defenses are playing them either. And, you know, you kind of go through these phases where New England had it, right? Like, Brady went through this stretch of, like, 7 or 8 or 9 years, right, without winning anything. And it's because teams adjust and maybe you get a little complacent. But I don't want to say that the Chiefs are complacent here, but there's some other things going on. When Mahomes comes out and wins MVPs and wins Super Bowls and goes to another, and Andy Reid gets the Super Bowl monkey off his back, and now you're dealing with all these situations off the field for the both of them, that's also a contributing factor here.
It's always interesting because, I mean, we've talked about it at great lengths, and it was evident in Stanford's glory days in the Pac-12 that Oregon wanted to go to the spread attack. They were going to be dynamic against teams that didn't have athletes in the defensive backfield. But the way that you could beat a team that was a little bit lighter was employing a brand of physical football. And I think to your point, when you talk about defenses and their ongoing evolution, you're seeing more defensive backs out there on the field. I mean, we saw it with the Miami Dolphins on Thursday night against the Baltimore Ravens when they swarmed Lamar Jackson and completely clamped clamp down. And we're going to see a team on full display later tonight in the form of the New England Patriots who's gone the exact opposite. They don't want to spread you out. They want to try and build around the offensive line. They want to use their tandem of backs and employ a heavier brand of football. And it almost feels like that circle of life in the National Football League, because we talk about it all the time. It's a copycat league, but as soon as somebody figures out ways to stop that offensive iteration, someone has to revert back to the old days. And right now, maybe we'll see a coming of age, an in vogue way to continue to run the football. And you mentioned Lamar Jackson. I think that provides a good avenue to go down. We talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, and we can bounce around a little bit. That Ravens offense appeared to be broken yet again. I mean, they were unable to capitalize against the Steelers defense, albeit one that had TJ Watt, who we weren't expecting to play, but operated in fits and spurts. Lamar throws that interception on the opening drive, and it never appeared that Baltimore was really going to put a true offensive scare into a Steelers stop unit that had been pretty vulnerable over the previous 2 weeks.
Yeah, TJ Watt, I believe, was the only player this year to go on the Big C list in the beginning portion of the week and then end up playing. So that was a little bit of a surprise to everyone. And we talked about their defensive EPA numbers with TJ Watt on the field versus without. It is glaring. It goes from, you know, a top 10 defense to a bottom five defense. And that's just how important he is. And Pittsburgh was able to get pressure. Now, I watched the opening drive, horrific interception in the end zone from Lamar. Not sure what he's doing there. But overall, it didn't feel like a game where neither operated optimally. It was like, hey, we're just kind of jab each other to start, and then we realize that this is going to be a tight game, and we're going to just play this AFC North physical style of football where we're just going to sit in the middle of the ring and like just body blow each other, and neither team wanted to operate optimally. It was very bizarre. But to your point, Lamar Jackson wasn't very good again. Completion percentage, 11% below expectation. Throwing to wrong reads. Now, give Mike Tomlin some credit, right? He knew his secondary couldn't hold up. He had to send pressure. Sent a ton of blitzes. Pittsburgh offensively suddenly dominated in the trenches late in that game. I mean, Najee Harris was doing nothing for 2.5-plus quarters, really 3 quarters. And then they just kind of enforced their will late in that game. Big Ben took advantage of a beat-up Ravens secondary. I think if you poll anybody on the Steelers staff, if you can get an offense that delivers a 51% success rate and Big Ben can throw for 7.4 an attempt, they're going to take that every single day and twice on Sunday, and that's going to keep them in this playoff hunt if Big Ben can play at that level. And that was really my mindset in that game, and I was like, you know, this could be a contrarian over here, because one, we think the Steelers defense is a little bit overrated, and we think there's some issues there if TJ Watt's out and some injuries in the secondary. And then I said to myself, if Pittsburgh can actually operate optimally, it's going to be a Big Ben throwing game. And sure enough, when they threw, there was a ton of opportunities. And the guys, there's like 4 or 5 guys questionable in the Ravens secondary leading up to that game. And guys like Marlon Humphrey didn't even practice late in the week. And then you see him on the sidelines in a basketball game on Friday night. You're like, okay, he's going to play. But he ends up exiting the game early along with another defensive back. So it felt very weird. Like, this could have been much easier had teams chosen the right path offensively. But again, when you get Mike Tomlin and, you know, he just wants to beat up everybody in the trenches, that's not how it's going to go, I guess.
Yeah, John Harbaugh with some interesting comments in the aftermath of that game, saying that defensive backfield, again, to your point, was extremely beat up, and that was the reason he elected to go for two rather than playing for overtime at that point in the game. Clearly something to monitor going forward, as the Browns will have a chance for revenge against the Baltimore Ravens, some extra time to prepare, and Baltimore clearly beat up against the Steelers. And one step further, this was a tweet that came from Next Gen Stats last night, Payne. TJ Watt in the game, 32 pass rushes, created 12 pressures at about a 38% rate, 3.5 sacks, 1 turnover caused by quarterback pressure. Alex Highsmith, 33 pass rushes, 8 pressures. So little to say that Steelers defense looks
that
a hell
Watt
of
guy
a
is good.
Yeah, looks a hell of a lot different. And ironic in the Watt family that TJ may end up having a better pass rushing legacy than his brother if he's able to stay healthy and on the football field.
I completely agree. And just in general, right? There's just more value to an end rusher than an interior guy most of the time. And it's difficult seeing JJ end his career constantly injured, and hopefully he's able to make another run. He's such a tough guy. I wonder if they make a Super Bowl if he just says F it and tries gutting it out. It'll be interesting to see how that works for Arizona. But you know, going back, like you mentioned those injuries in the secondary, and that's why Harbaugh elected to go for too late. Like, what a Big Ben and what a Big Ben's numbers look like if Deontay Johnson doesn't have the drops again before half? I mean, that ball was put perfectly in the bucket, and he just drops like a 40-yard touchdown before the break.
And then you have the ball on the opening drive of the second half. I think it was the opening drive for the Steelers that I'm still not sure how the officials overturned out to midfield. I didn't see conclusive evidence on that particular play. So there's no doubt.
I missed that play. Was that the one to the Clemson kid?
Yes.
Is that McLeod?
Yep. Okay. And I mean, it was a bang-bang play. I think the call in the field probably should have stood. So I was a little bit surprised when they reversed that. But there's no doubt Ben had a chance for a 300-yard day. And who knows? Maybe Big Ben, with all the storylines clearly that his people dropped about retirement at the end of the season, will use this as a send-off. We'll see him play with a chip on his shoulder. And, of course, the Steelers will run it back on a short week against the Minnesota Vikings. Lions, Payne, they find a way to break into the win column. Great for Dan Campbell and that organization. But while the Lions' victory was outstanding, you begin to wonder what the hell the Minnesota Vikings are doing defensively in these late game situations.
Take nothing away from the Lions, right? Like, great first win, much deserved. They came out fast, built the 2-score lead going into halftime. And if you look at the first half stats, it was a Dan Campbell team that was far more prepared than what Mike Zimmer had his team to go out there and play at. Like, I mean, we're just looking at right now, net positive 20% success rate in the first half, and a positive net positive 2.7 yards per play in the first half for Detroit. So Zimmer's defense failed early, and then it failed late. And it was a mash unit, right? Like, no Danielle Hunter, as we know, Everson Griffin out. And then all of a sudden on game day, Kendrick's out, Anthony Barr out. We knew Patrick Peterson was going to be out. And that's why you saw the Lions take game day money from +7.5 down to about 6.8 where it closed. But I would say Zimmer's days are probably numbered unless there's a wild end of season run. Like, when you have a defensive-minded head coach effectively cripple the offense strategically, and then his defense gives up another game-winning drive, you probably have to move on. Like, Zimmer still hasn't figured his team out with its current injury situation and talent that it should be an offensive team first, but it's not. And so you see Minnesota finally forced out of its shell, playing catch-up in the second half, 9.9 yards per attempt in the second half through the air. So if you're going to handicap the offense, your defense can't give up game-winning drives to Cooper Rush and now Jared Goff. And if you watched Zim, he calls a timeout before that last play to, like, trot out this uber-conservative style defense. I mean, what was that call? It's like Zimmer thought he was defending a Hail Mary. Everyone got a free release.
I have no idea.
Defensive backs were playing soft. Feet were in the end zone instead of on the goal line. I mean, it was pitch and catch. And the guy who gives up the touchdowns, Cam Dantzler. If you looked at how he defended the entire game, he's the best player on the field. Had the best coverage grade of anyone on the field. He's like, hey, we're just going to have him play this soft mirror coverage and then have the safety with inside support sit in the back of the end zone. I mean, it was literal pitch and catch.
Yeah, I mean, there was no degree of difficulty there for the Detroit Lions. You figure you have to make Jared Goff throw the ball into a tight window, generate some pressure, do something to get him off the spot. But the entire drive, an absolute crime against humanity for the Minnesota Vikings, and a team that, you know, we've talked about at great lengths, being so close yet so far away in these endgame situations. And for yet another week, the Vikings see their outcome of a game decided on the final play, making laying points with them an extremely delicate proposition. Cincinnati and Los Angeles, Payne. It was a game that we talked about not only here on the Bet the Board podcast, but we also previewed in a more concise manner on the Bet the Board pregame show. And the biggest thing and the overarching element was market efficiency, that maybe the Chargers were finally being fairly priced for the first time in recent weeks. They run out to a big lead. The Cincinnati Bengals find a way to battle back. And to the Chargers' credit, they find some separation. But the one thing for me that really stood out, at least the Chargers, albeit against a banged up Bengals offensive line, were competent in neutralizing the effectiveness of Joe Mixon from start to finish.
Yeah. And, you know, Linval Joseph was out, which is really the Chargers' big guy on the interior of the defensive line. So that was causing some concern. There was energy early defensively. You could see guys flying around. So Brandon Staley certainly got those guys motivated early. But games like yesterday are why Zach Taylor shouldn't even be considered for Coach of the Year. There's just so much Jekyll and Hyde from that Bengals offense. And it wasn't like the Bengals had like the greatest offensive output against the Raiders the week prior, if you actually look at the game the right way. It's very feast or famine right now for Cincy's offense. Basically, the scheme is very meat and potatoes. They don't really change much, and that's something we've said from the onset. There's just elite talent executing it. But when Ja'Marr Chase has the drops again and your quarterback dislocates his finger on his throwing hand and two starting O-line linemen are out, that talent can't overcome bad design and play calling. But you know, take nothing away from the Chargers, right? It's just you look at the overall numbers here. Defense holds the Bengals to 5.2 per play, a 40% success rate. The key, though, is the offense. It built a 24-0 lead, which forces the Bengals into more predictable situations on offense, which then helps the defense. And I say this all the time, build a lead, right? Make your opponent predictable. And suddenly your defense will look a lot better. And I think the message got across to Joe Lombardi and Brandon Staley, because if you look at this number, one we've been kind of pounding the table for, Justin Herbert. Highest average intended air yards of the week at 10.2.
About damn time.
Yep. Build leads, make your defense look competent by having to see offenses that are in a little bit more predictable situations.
I mean, my Lord, you begin to wonder exactly. I mean, that's what Kansas City's done so effectively. You're built to play with the lead with a dynamic quarterback out there. You don't have to be an elite run-stopping unit. If a team is playing from behind, you can pin your ears back and come after the opposing quarterback. And for the Chargers, for a little while, when they get outscored 9-0 in the third quarter, you think, oh, this Chargers team is going to find a way to piss it away. If it wasn't for a defensive touchdown, you know, who knows how that game goes. Of course, the Chargers did play the better part of three quarters without their leading pass rusher in Joey Bosa. Will monitor his situation. Appears to be head related, so have to think he'll be a game time decision when they'll play host to the New York Giants next weekend. Gardner Minshew Payne, was it all about him and the Philadelphia offensive resurgence, or more about Jets ineptitude and Robert Saleh having his hands full with his stop unit?
You know, peel back the curtain a little bit here, because you and I had a discussion about Eagles and Jets a couple times over the course of the week, and I think we're both kind of leaning Philly, as wild as that sounds. And I debated laying 6.5, and then it crept out to 7. And then we had the announcement that Jalen Hurts was out. And we saw the market close as low as 4. And I kind of sent you a text, and it's like, I'd rather lay 4 with Minshew than 7 with Hurts. And I think people kind of know my opinion on Minshew. Is he a franchise quarterback? No. But we did comment on that trade and thought the Eagles got the better of it. Because I think in this system, he can be really good. And for this matchup specifically, the way you want to attack the Jets is through the air. You want to attack their linebackers, which we saw Dallas Goedert crush early in that game. And so Minshew came out, and this may stun some people, completion percentage 14% above expectation, number one of the week. Justin Herbert was at 11%, number two. That just kind of gives you an idea of how good Gardner Minshew was yesterday. But it was a total team effort, right? The Jets were on fire early. Great script, great play calling, tons of motion that was giving the Eagles defense some problems. But the Eagles made adjustments defensively the final three quarters, and over that stretch, the Jets averaged 4.3 yards per play and a 41% success rate. So Minshew did a great job helping the Eagles keep pace early, and then the defense took over late.
Yeah, there was no doubt you saw them kind of flip a switch in a game where the Jets, I believe, led 18-12 at one point or thereabouts, end up not scoring for the better part of two-plus quarters, with the Eagles pitching a shutout in the second half. As far as some of the other positives that you witnessed over the course of the NFL day, Payne, anything in particular that really stood out?
I mean, let's give the Rams a little credit, right? That's exactly what we wanted to see, because we weren't sure it was there, right? Lots of speculation of injuries to Stafford and players, I wouldn't say calling out the coaching staff, but basically saying, hey, we need to be unleashed here, right? The best players don't want to be constricted to a scheme or system. You just kind of got to let them play sometimes. And you're off three straight losses. And so you just kind of, I understand it's the Jaguars, but you need to see them kick some ass. And so they went out there and enforced their will and took their frustrations out, and they were able to work on things. And it looks like they got some of their swagger back. And, you know, I think there's this idea out there that sharp bettors don't lay points or they only take dogs. And it's a total myth. Like, value is value, right? You're sitting here looking at a $100 bill and someone tells you it's priced at $83. Like, you're gonna buy that $100 bill for $83. Now, maybe not right now, inflation, but, you know, that's kind of my point here. Is
that $100 bill might actually be worth $23.50 actually, when you figure out the weighted cost of capital.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, if you're looking at the Rams in the, and you're factoring in like the spot, in the situation, in the matchup, and let's say you made the game like 16, like you're going to have no problem laying 12.5. And that's kind of what happened on game day. We saw that line go from 12.5 out to 14.5 at some places. Stafford was good, right? Completion percentage, 5% above expectation. It's not the end all be all. Shaquille Griffin was out, who's the Jaguars' best cover corner. But Stafford was good, 8.1 an attempt, 66% passing success rate, 4 explosives. So you're starting to get OBJ more integrated into the offense. We'll find out if it's for real. Monday night at Arizona. This is a game where we find out if the Rams are going to compete with the big boys in the NFC. And it's obviously a Monday night game, so we'll break it down extensively.
Yeah, man. Special thanks to the scheduling gods for what they've given us this week with the Bills and Patriots and next week with the Rams and 49ers. Given the fact that we've had so many duds, it feels like under the bright lights, and we'll get one of those next week in Sunday Night Football with the Green Bay Packers, nearly a 2-touchdown favorite at home against Lambeau when they take on the Chicago Bears. But you raise an excellent point, and I think it goes, and it's worth repeating for a lot of our listeners out there, that it doesn't just apply to the National Football League or college football or any other sports. This idea that value you can only come in the form of taking an underdog couldn't be more founded in myth than actual reality. And the same thing applies to futures and all of that. If you find a team that's a favorite and you think that they're actually being undervalued there, there's nothing wrong with taking a team at plus $1.10 somewhere along the lines. Then instead of going, you know what, I need to try and find a long shot that's 80-1 because you think they should be 72-1 to win the Lombardi Trophy. So always do your homework and understand that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but value can manifest itself in a variety of different ways. As far as ugly pain, I mean, we talked a little bit about it. The Steelers and Ravens was where I really wanted to focus, but I felt we did an adequate job there. Were there any individual performances that you wanted to highlight in a negative manner before we get into, you know, completely eviscerating what we've seen from the Houston Texans week in, week out?
No. Let's start there. You can go ahead with your Texans rant.
I mean,
right,
I feel bad beating up on a team that's clearly going through a transitional state, to say the least, but they've shown no improvement whatsoever.
Transitioning.
We've seen no improvement whatsoever. And if you're trying to figure out what you have as an organization in a rookie quarterback in Davis Mills, why is he not starting week in, week out? At least go into the offseason knowing, hey, this guy can be serviceable. He can be a placeholder until we find the heir apparent for what Deshaun Watson brought. But yet again, the Houston Texans offense bottoms out. 9 first downs, less than 3 yards per play. Davis Mills finishes 6 of 14. Tyrod Taylor, 5 of 13. As a group, 19 carries for 84 yards running the football, and Brandon Cooks highlights the receiving group with 3 catches for 38 yards. But you could tell off the first drive or two that unless the Colts took their foot off the accelerator on the defensive side, Houston was never going to mount a real legitimate threat moving the football.
2.8 yards per play and a 30% success rate. Tyrod Taylor is a guy that at the beginning of the season when we broke down the Texans said, hey, you know, he's a professional. And there's some veterans on that team and they'll probably play with some pride. He came out, looked pretty good early, right? They beat the Jacksonville Jaguars to start the season. And then for the first 30 minutes are giving the Browns everything they could handle at home, and then he goes down with an injury. And so when Tyrod came back, while we didn't think it made sense organizationally, right? Throw Davis Mills in there. He was your third round pick. Let's find out what you have. They went back to Tyrod Taylor to be a little bit more competitive, and Tyrod Taylor's been anything but that. I know you went on the road and beat the Titans, but that was another game with less than 200 yards of total offense, and Tyrod had two touchdowns on the ground, and that's, you know, still the strength of his game. But Houston yesterday, 1.8 yards per pass attempt, 26% passing success rate, zero explosive passes. It's not a good offense. There's not a lot of talent. And I do think at some point you have to go back to Davis Mills just to figure out what he has, right? And I understand the numbers haven't looked good, but we know what Tyrod Taylor is at this point. We know David Culley is a placement, just a little holder. And so this just needs to be a complete regroup. It never made sense, right? You look at the roster construction at the beginning of the season for the Texans. What was it? It was like, hey, we're just going to sign a ton of veterans. I don't know. It's one thing to like bring in a couple and build culture for the young guys, but it was the complete opposite. They thought they might have a chance here, which is just wild to me. So that organization, you feel bad for it. They're going to have a ton of picks. They're probably going to trade Sean Watson, get a ton more picks. And your hope is that their new GM doesn't piss down his leg with all that ammunition.
Yeah, I mean, it's a full-blown rebuild there. It's not something that's going to happen overnight, but I think you brought up the key word in culture, trying to figure out who can be the man to lead the charge there and resurrect the team that, for all intents and purposes, had really been a playoff fixture with Deshaun Watson. I know we talked about early in the year, but amazing to think we're only about 18 months removed from Houston having a double-digit lead on the road at Arrowhead against the Kansas City Chiefs, where the final 2.5 quarters has kind of served as a harbinger of things that we've seen, everything going on in Houston since that point. So amazing how quickly things change in the National Football League. But anything else?
And we didn't even think it was a great roster with Deshaun.
No.
That's why we knew Deshaun was awesome, because he was propping up a team that was probably at the time maybe a 5 or 6 win team at best. And then Deshaun took them to playoff caliber. That's how good Deshaun Watson was.
Yeah, I mean, he had the same impact on that Houston Texans roster from top to bottom like Russell Wilson did, kind of elevating that Seattle Seahawks team once they started to lose a lot of their key cogs on the defensive side of the ball, specifically in the secondary, and then obviously along the offensive line. But do we give the Seahawks full marks, Payne, or do we take shots at the 49ers for what we saw in the Pacific Northwest yesterday?
I think you give Seattle credit because they showed fight, they showed effort, they showed some intensity, and give Pete Carroll credit early. You get the quick 3-and-out. It's like, here we go again for Russ in this offense, and boom, you have the spark plug, fake punt, 70-yard touchdown, and that really puts some life into them. And then all of a sudden, San Francisco regroups themselves. They go up 14-7, and they could have quit at that point, but they didn't. Russ kind of battled back, took the reins again, second quarter, early third quarter. Had them entrenched in that game. Shouldn't have been that difficult. Up 7, going in for a 2-score lead. Pete finally makes the right decision. I totally thought he was going to kick a field goal to make it a 10-point game. Goes for it on 4th-and-1, picks it up. So now Seattle's in prime position. You're at the 3-yard line, 1st-and-goal, up 7 with the ball. And then Travis Homer fumbles. And so game on. And you could have lost that game. Defense came up with some timely turnovers. That game had just a ton of turnovers. But ultimately, again, the Seahawks had a 2% chance of making the playoffs. They looked dead and buried. We said on the Monday night preview that in front of a national audience, they would be on their best behavior in terms of energy and effort. That wasn't necessarily the case. And so you got to this point where it's the old debate. We have San Francisco at -2.5 with revenge and everything on the line, and we saw it get out to 3.5. And we know the 3 is just the most important number in the NFL, and finally the number became so ridiculous that you saw professional bettors come in and grab Seattle +3.5. Sunday morning, it was like soft 3.5, mostly 3. And then right before kickoff, another wave of Seattle money came in. Game closed back at 2.5. So there was professional money on Seattle just kind of saying, listen, this number's just gotten so out of whack. And then you double down and you say, well, potentially the two best players, one on each side of the ball, are out. Now, Kittle is mammoth for the 49ers offense, but Debo Samuel is out, and then you had Fred Warner out defensively. And so it was just too much value to pass up for a lot of professional bettors. So they did get home there with a very ugly dog.
Don't look now. The Seattle Seahawks 1-0 with Adrian Peterson in the lineup as he looked about 107 years old.
Oh my God. Carrying the
football yet again. And while he's had a well-decorated career, you hope for Adrian Peterson's sake and everyone that watches football throughout the course of the season, every Sunday, that this is the end of Adrian Peterson this season and he can finally hang it up. But I have a feeling he may find himself on the Frank Gore plan more so than anything else. But, you know, a busy day.
Frank Gore is a much better option than Adrian Peterson right now.
I would agree.
It's not even a question because he doesn't turn the ball over. He doesn't run upright. He can still get 2 yards and fall forward.
Well, we'll have to see.
I think this is always the interesting part about sports, because anyone that's probably in their early to mid-20s has a far different perception of Adrian Peterson than we do. And we're kind of at the age now where we've seen guys go from freshman in college to retirement, and so we have the full encompassing career. But if you were like 23 right now watching Adrian Peterson, you have no idea that the guy was an absolute horse at Oklahoma. Literally and figuratively ran like a horse. Like, his head would bob. He was just so freaking fast. And the strength and size is just a rare combination. Watching him now is tough to watch. And I don't know how anybody saw what he did in Tennessee and was like, you know what? We need to sign that guy, because he's had the fumbles in Tennessee. He's running completely upright. He doesn't have the strength and power. It's just mind-boggling. Pete was like, I watched the Tennessee film. Hey, looks good. We're going to sign that guy.
You know, maybe
mind-blowing.
Maybe it allows Pete the full career arc, because he realizes that he wasn't able to lure Adrian Peterson out to the West Coast when he was head coach at USC, had to watch him on tape as the bell cow back for Oklahoma, and figures, you know what? I want to ride this horse into the ground as he goes into the twilight of his career. But a big win for the Seahawks nonetheless. The 49ers, a team that was white hot coming in, they'll have their hands full this weekend as they'll travel across the country to take on the Bengals, with the 49ers actually as short road favorites in that spot. And Payne, I think it provides the perfect transition for us to do a real quick superficial look at some of the look ahead adjustments courtesy of FanDuel Sportsbook as far as week 14 is concerned. And the perfect place to start would be with the Thursday night football game, where look ahead number had the Vikings listed as a 4.5 point favorite. That number, by virtue of the Vikings loss to the Lions, the Steelers win against the Ravens, has this price down to Minnesota -3. But of course, the big injury that we're going to monitor up until kickoff on Thursday night, the status and potential of availability for Minnesota's second best receiver in Adam Thielen.
There you go. You covered it perfectly. That's exactly why this price has come down from 4.5 to 3, right? The stench of losing to the Lions, the Steelers winning outright as a home dog and with their playoff lives on the line, and then the downgrade for Adam Thielen. That is why we've seen this movement. We'll obviously break the game down in a little bit more detail on Thursday.
Cleveland and the Ravens as well. We saw the favorite flip in this one. The Ravens were a 1 point favorite on a look ahead. Cleveland now 2, taking a little bit of money Monday morning along with the under in that particular game. Talked about the issues that the Ravens may have as far as their defensive backfield is concerned. I know you have some great nuggets on teams playing rematches within a very short period of time that I think our listeners will find fascinating when we disclose those on Thursday night. But not a move through a key number here. Obviously, only really impacts the teaser window at this point.
Yes, we had Baltimore go from -1. Now Cleveland, I would say, is -1.5, trending towards 2, 2.5 off the bye. Right, that's going to be the team I think probably is able to make some more adjustments. It wasn't the best performance from their ground game. Baltimore was able to stifle that a little bit, and when you're a run-first team, it's going to look pretty ugly. But this feels like it's the last stand for the Browns. It really does. And so let's see what Kevin Stefanski comes with off the bye. There's also a trend with teams playing Pittsburgh the week after that hasn't necessarily bode well, because of typically it is a physical game. I just think we kind of realize, and this is something we said just kind of in talking the last couple of weeks, we're like, yeah, Baltimore is really not, you know, an 8-3 type team. And when you look at Pythag, and I know we had we had a comment from someone that said very similar to, you know, Cincinnati's not a 6.5 win team like oddsmakers thought before the season. We use Pythag numbers. So, like, I don't even care what their record is, what it says on ESPN's, you know, win-loss column. We kind of look at these teams as they actually are with their Pythag and how many wins they should have. And Baltimore right now is a team that has the largest variance with actual record versus what the Pythag states they are. So that's partly this movement, as well as people understanding that Baltimore is not as good as their record. And sometimes that perception of record creates some value in the market.
Can only outrun the numbers for so long before regression lurks around the next corner. Seattle out to an 8-point favorite at FanDuel Sportsbook. Look ahead number here was 6.5 when they'll make a trip down to Texas to take on the Houston Texans.
It'll be interesting to see who Houston goes with under center. And I think that will be a cause for some of this. Now, I don't think all is right in the world of Seattle. So that is quite interesting to see that large of a movement. Ultimately, we'll see what ends up being the true side there. But quite a bit of adjustment through a key number. Let's see who Houston trots out there.
Game out on the West Coast. Chargers look ahead number had them a 7-point favorite as they'll welcome in the New York Football Giants. That number has ballooned out to 10. Growing speculation, I haven't seen anything official, that Jake Fromm could make his NFL starting debut in this particular spot. And something to keep in mind, the Giants will not return home to the tri-state area. They're actually fly out to Tucson. They're going to practice there all week before heading out to SoFi Stadium to take on the Chargers.
Yep. Good catch. Good spot. Giants typically perform better on the road. You mentioned Fromm. It's interesting to see what is the status of Daniel Jones, because he was kind of in the middle of this week and then he wasn't. Let's monitor that situation a little bit. That's what's kind of bizarre about this.
Yeah, I'm right there.
I would expect Shepard to be up in this game. So, you know, that's a pretty lofty move from 7 to 10.5, right? Like, basically off the 7 and then through the 10. That's a pretty large move there.
There is no doubt about it, but you're right. When you talk about the Daniel Jones stuff, he was in, he was out, he was out, he was in. I mean, you and I texted about it Friday morning trying to figure out what the hell was going on before the Giants officially said that it was going to be the Mike Glennon show with a robust 9-point offensive outburst right down there in your backyard. Perfect time to remind
12. Could have been 12. They were down 2 scores and kicked that field goal with 8 seconds left, hoping to make it, then recover the onside kick, and then score a touchdown all within 8 seconds.
Hey, it would have been a rather improbable sequence, but you know, that's where the NFL goes. They try and invent new ways to keep fans entertained in one form or fashion each and every Sunday. Encourage you guys to follow Payne on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. Go to FanDuel.com/BetTheBoard. Take advantage of your 30-1 new user sign-up promotion for tonight's game between the New England Patriots and the Buffalo Bills. And Payne, we're looking at the Bills, a 2.5-point favorite. You do have to lay $1.20 at FanDuel Sportsbook right now. The money line hovering right around $1.40. Total on this game, 41. And there are a variety of ways where we can go with this game. Just want to kind of lay some things out real quickly, and I'll throw the ball to you. You know, only two teams in the league so far this season have outscored their opposition by 140-plus points. The two teams we'll see on display tonight. The Patriots have won 6 straight. It's now the longest win streak in the league this season. Their point per game differential in that span, 24.7. It's actually the best any team has accomplished in a 6-game span since the Patriots way back in 2010. Meanwhile, Buffalo, you're seeing a slight changing of the guard within the AFC East. They're now 9-0 within the division since the start of last year. They were able to sweep the Patriots last season for the first time since 1999, and they've won their last 5 divisional games all by double digits. Whether going to play a role, no doubt about it. And when you look at Bill Belichick in his career, I know it comes with a caveat that most of these games were with Tom Brady, 53-27-3 against the spread, catching points, 66% success rate. He's actually won 44 games out of the 82 he's caught points outright for a 54% win rate. Whether Pat's offense, Bill's defense, Pat's defense, I'll give you the floor.
You give an NFL guy the floor, and he's going to tell you that Manny Diaz officially fired. Done. pulled off the road. Game over. Oregon holding a team meeting in a few hours. So it looks like Mario Cristobal officially the next head coach of the Miami Hurricanes. Interesting stuff there.
Do we begin to speculate? I mean, is there a chance that Phil Knight sends his jet out to Boca Raton and tries to bring Willie Taggart back in, knowing he tried to do everything he could to keep Willie as their head coach before he bolted for Florida State a few years ago?
God, would that be a bad hire? What's up with Chip? You have to hire someone from the West Coast, because I'm not a massive Mario Cristobal guy. He can recruit his butt off, and he's organized, and he's buttoned up, and he's not the best X's and O's guy. And even in saying that, he is far above Miami's current weight class, but Miami is starting to get serious about winning again. And so that was the sell, along with going back home. But this is now how many coaches in a row you've lost because they want to operate on the East Coast. So you have to find somebody in this next hiring, if you're Oregon, that is wanting to stay on the West Coast. You can't dabble, I don't think, in the Midwest or the East Coast.
Nope. And you wonder how accomplished a resume your head coach has to have. Do you want to go in a younger direction? I thought it was interesting, and I believe I sent you the tweet where you had someone from the Oregonian speculating that they would make a call to Chip Kelly to try and lure him back to Eugene. You never know if that's a leverage play, though, as I'm sure Chip sees the amount of money that his crosstown rival has paid Lincoln Riley to try and get a few more dollars there. But I think it would be fascinating because Chip, to my knowledge, left on pretty good terms when he bolted for Oregon for the NFL. I don't think there was a lot of acrimony there, but you know, no doubt about it, a team like Oregon with deep pockets and all of that Nike money, I think you're nailed it when you talk about keeping a guy that wants to be on the West Coast and is committed to building a true power up there in the Pacific Northwest, since recruiting is always going to be the real key cog, knowing you don't have a talent rich state right in your backyard.
There's no doubt. Now, I think the job became slightly less appealing now that Lincoln Riley's at USC. You went from being 1A west of Texas to 1B. And that discrepancy is probably larger than we think if Lincoln Riley does it correct. And it looks like he's going to. I mean, the talent he's already pulling in the first 3-4 days is ridiculous. Okay. On to what people actually want to hear. The NFL, rumor has it the Patriots and Bills are playing tonight for first place in the division and potentially first place in the AFC, which is massive, right? Only one team gets a bye. It's a weird game. Let me kind of just phrase it that way. We saw some early money come in on New England at +3. I did see a couple guys lay the 2.5 that had a different mindset. So there's a little bit of a battle here on the side. In terms of the matchup, let's start with the Patriots offense. And I think that's, when you're looking at it, everyone has talked the Patriots run game, right? That's been a huge part of their offensive identity and their success. And the offensive line's finally healthy. And if you look over this 6-game win streak, New England's number one in EPA per play, number one in EPA per pass, third in EPA per rush. So it's not just the run game, but it does set some things up. It's just a really well-prepared offense. It's a very balanced offense. They disguise things formationally. They're efficient running and passing, so defenses can't cheat and focus on specific things. So most of the time, everything looks pretty similar pre-snap, and it just makes things difficult. Then you look at the Bills' defense, and most people are going to be like, boy, you know, they've played absolutely nobody, and that's true, right? Dead last schedule of offenses played for Buffalo. And the best offense on the Bills' schedule was a top 10 offense in the Colts, and Indianapolis crushed them in the trenches and just overpowered them in the run game. That's also very true. And then you look at Buffalo style and you're like, okay, they play too high shell. So by design, McDermott's willing to give up more on the ground than through the air. It's a sound strategy. Roster wise, Buffalo wants their defensive linemen more quick and fast than bulky and plodding. So it's kind of this twofold thing on why they can be had on the ground. And I know, again, the metrics don't necessarily depict that. It looks like a top 5 run defense, and we've been kind of telling you that's not necessarily the case. But I'll be blunt here. Sean McDermott and Leslie Frazier have to make an adjustment tonight, right? With the matchup in front of them, with the simple look at Mac Jones's passing grid, right? He's just substantially better when he's not throwing it deep. He's just better in these small windows so far. And then you look at 27 mile per hour winds and projected gusts well into the 40s as we break this down. You'd be out of your freaking mind to play too high shell here. You have to put more defenders in the box. And that's kind of what shocked me in the Colts game. If you go back and actually dig into that, where, I mean, Indy just bludgeons the Bills. Jonathan Taylor only ran into an 8-man box on 3% of his carries. How there wasn't an in-game adjustment is just bizarre. And I understand, like, philosophically, you want to be who you are. You don't really want to change from that. But you have to here. The positive for Buffalo is that if you do look at that game, their middle linebacker was out. So you had basically the quarterback of the defense and Tremaine Edmonds out for the game. You had defensive tackle Star Luatelli was out. Both those guys are obviously playing in this game. And Star Luatelli is kind of the one guy that has some bulk along the interior of the defensive line. Looking at Buffalo's numbers, they give up about 25% less rushing yards when Star Luatelli's in versus when he's out. In terms of success rate, Buffalo's allowed 37% success rate in games that Star has played, 47% success rate allowed in games that he's missed. I do think Tre'Davious White is a huge loss long term. Probably their best defender. Maybe it is tonight, but I think it can be camoed somewhat with some of these weather conditions. Two things to look at. One is Matt Milano. He's got to get back into form. Coverage-wise, it's really difficult asking linebackers to cover this day and age, but Milano's been one of the best the past few seasons. He's finished top three in pass coverage success rate allowed each of the last three seasons. So far this year, Milano's 12th in coverage grade among linebackers with at least 200 coverage snaps. So he's dipped down a little bit. He's going to need to be awesome. Obviously, you know, you talked about that transition, Todd, about how teams were kind of going away from things. Really, Bill Belichick's been at the forefront, right? He kind of spent a little bit more and brought guys back along the offensive line, doubled down with two tight ends, and he's gone to this ground and pound attack as teams defensively have shifted to defend passing attacks. So it's been very successful, and Belichick's been ahead of that curve. So obviously Matt Milano's huge tonight when you're talking about defending Hunter Henry, who's coming on strong of late, and then Jonnu Smith. Milano in coverage is going to need to have a big night. Another matchup is Jacoby Myers in the slot against Taron Johnson. Myers lines up in the slot about 67% of his snaps among slot corners that have faced at least 300 coverage snaps. Taron Johnson, number one in coverage yards per snap allowed. So there are some really nice games within the games here. This is going to come down to schematically what Buffalo elects to do defensively. If they come out in too high shell, New England's probably going to be able to run the ball a little bit. If you're looking at the matchup and the weather, you need to devise a game plan that has more defenders in the box for Buffalo. And you need to get pressure on Mac Jones because he's been a little bit turnover prone when he's got some heat on him a little bit. So that'll be interesting, right? Just figuring out what Buffalo is going to do defensively tonight.
I know Bill got a little ornery when asked about the weather and how you prepare a team. And Bill, and of course, his always, you know, positive, uplifting demeanor says, we've practiced in sun, we've practiced in rain, we've practiced in dry, we've practiced in this. But I do think it bears asking, and clearly you don't know how someone's going to respond until they're thrown into that situation. Mac Jones is a kid that played his high school football in Jacksonville, Florida. He played his college football in Tuscaloosa. Suffice to say, this will be the first time he's dealing with this kind of cold and wind. I know he played in a rainstorm against Tampa earlier this year, but a little bit different than the circumstance he's going to encounter in Orchard Park, New York this evening.
That's the interesting debate because there's some narrative to it, right? If you like New England, they're much better equipped to play in this weather. And that's probably true with their ground and pound attack. But if you're asking which quarterback is more equipped to potentially play in this weather, it's obviously Josh Allen with a stronger arm. And so that becomes the interesting dynamic here and why this game is getting two-way play. Because the number is pretty spot on, I think. I would make this like Buffalo minus 1.5 on a neutral and then give them a solid home field advantage. So maybe you get to like 3 flat, soft 3, maybe. Like it's kind of where this is at. You know, the next move will be pretty telling. I don't know if there will be one, but again, it's a lot of narrative based and matchup stuff, right? If you believe that New England's going to be able to run the ball tonight, they're probably going to have a little bit of an edge. If you think that the weather is not going to be an impact for Josh Allen because of his strong arm, you know, you may lean that way a little bit. I think Mac Jones overall is, I'm higher on him than just about anybody else. I think you know, listeners know that at this point. He's just a very accurate quarterback. And does that accuracy take a little dip if the wind is severe enough? Potentially, right? But that's kind of the debate here. It's, what do you want? The ground and pound, that's an advantage for New England, potentially. Quarterback arm strength, obviously Josh Allen. No one on planet Earth has a stronger arm than Josh Allen.
There is no doubt that he is cerebral. The work ethic is there. I'm curious to see how he performs on a big stage as well. You mentioned Josh Allen, and there's when you look at Josh Allen and what he's been able to accomplish up until his last game against the New England Patriots, he'd really struggled against this particular team. 51% completion, 3 touchdowns, 6 picks, 6.5 yards an attempt, and a rating of 58. But for Allen in this game, Buffalo is obviously going to have to provide a semblance of a balanced attack, and you'd think that gets a little bit more straightforward with the return of two key cogs on the offensive line that you highlighted on the Bet the Board pregame show that aired on Friday.
Yeah, I this side of the ball for me has a ton of variance. Now, maybe the weather doesn't allow the variance to take shape, but New England's played a crap schedule of offenses, third easiest to date. We know Buffalo has not played a great schedule either. And so within that, sometimes you get these very up and down performances. It's not as steady and as easy to project. Belichick plays this bend but don't break defense. We know that. But last week against the Titans, scoreboard looks great. New England forced a Titans offense without its best lineman, best running back, and two best receivers to only punt twice. And so we've kind of been banging this drum that while the parts are better because New England spent some money in the offseason and got guys to return, and it's not as good of a defense, I think, as the metrics indicate. Now, Buffalo's offense has unquestionably regressed as well. Josh Allen is not playing at the elite level he was. Defenses, again, to our point with, you know, Mahomes and Lamar, like, defenses figured out how to better defend Buffalo. Daboll hasn't adjusted as quickly, and Buffalo just isn't as good as most teams are playing left-handed. But there are ways to beat New England's defense. The Patriots do a very good job, right? Like, they're just buttoned up. They're well-prepared. They have a ton of interchangeable chess pieces to do what Belichick wants schematically. But they're not, like, the greatest chess pieces, if that makes sense. So there's certainly some opportunities where, at times, you can bully New England, which we saw last week the Titans did with two no-name running backs. Each of them had over 100 yards. You can target guys like Bentley and Hightower with the throw game, right, with tight ends and running backs. The Patriots lack size in the secondary. And also, let's monitor this Kyle Duggar situation. He's on the big C list. Patriots have until 4 p.m. to activate him. He's not only one of the versatile chess pieces, but he's actually a good one, right? He played the fourth most defensive snaps for New England. He's good in coverage. You can line him up on the line and send him as a blitzer if you want. Decent in the run game. Now, one of the ways to beat New England is with, like, the quick, on time, accurate short passes. That doesn't necessarily scream Josh Allen. But if you look, New England's defense, 27th in efficiency defending passes within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. They're number one defending throws in the 11 to 20 yard range. So Josh Allen has to play his best game of the season. His worst passing window is 0 to 9 yards, more picks than touchdowns, 86 passer rating. Now, if you actually dig into some of those numbers, there could be real positive regression there. Allen has an 86% adjusted accuracy rate in that 0 to 9 yard window. Receivers have dropped 10 balls. It's just been wild there. So he's going to need some help from his receivers. Because this is a high leverage game with first place in the division on the line and first place in the AFC and a, you know, first round bye on the line, I would expect Josh Allen to run more here. Design runs could work quite well from what we have seen against New England. Buffalo really needs to, you know, the weapons have improved. They really need to figure out, like, who a big body receiver is. That's why Dawson Knox has been integrated a little bit more this season. New England doesn't really have a big body guy, and that would be an advantage you would have, but Buffalo really doesn't have that in their arsenal. Diggs obviously needs to be the man tonight. You've paid him handsomely. He's done pretty well against J.C. Jackson, who we really like. But if you look at last year's matchups, Buffalo just was able to target Diggs. There really wasn't much ability to stop him. One of those games was like a torrential downpour. He had 15 catches for 237 yards and 3 touchdowns in the 2 matchups against New England last year. I do think the secondary is a little bit more equipped to stop him. You mentioned at the top some of the offensive line get backs for Buffalo tonight. Certainly the O-line health looks much improved. It appears that Spencer Brown and John Feliciano are back. Now, big guys that miss extended time probably are not going to have their stamina to where it needs to be, but it would be big if they're both out there battling. We talked about Feliciano on the pregame show. He is really the guy that stirs the drink along the offensive line, which is crazy to say because he's not like the best offensive lineman they have, but he's the guy that is cerebral, very smart. He gets things organized. He gets things set up. He helps with protections and calls out blitzes. Since he's been in Buffalo, the Bills average about 8.5 more points per game with John Feliciano in the lineup. So that would be big getting him back tonight. But there's just a lot of things that we have to kind of navigate here, right? One of which is the weather. And the reports we know looked terrible on Monday morning. We saw a lot of undermoney come in from 45.5. We're now down to 41. Middle of the week, it didn't look as bad for kickoff. We had some guys start discussing positioning themselves for an over, and then all of a sudden the last 2 days, the weather looks bad again. And sometimes in Buffalo, the weather looks far worse than it actually is on some of the weather apps that you'll use as a handicapper because of this lake effect thing, which doesn't necessarily get picked up in some of the weather data that you will receive throughout the week. So I know like we have a guy that'll be positioned there. And we'll see what it looks like on the field at kickoff.
Storm of the century, Payne. Storm of the century.
Isn't that a movie?
What is it? The Perfect Storm, I think, is the name of the movie, right?
I'm looking right now. You have me intrigued. I'm typing. No. The Storm of the Century.
See, there we go. Great podcast content for those people listening along at home.
It is a movie. It is a movie. February 14th, 1999. Editor, Sonny Baskin. Director, Craig R. Baxley. There you go.
It's good to know. I had no idea it actually turned into a movie.
Yes. Yes, it is a movie. It looks like a long one.
So you can buckle in.
There you go.
Buckle up and there you go. Have a chance to keep yourself entertained. But yeah, I think, all the things that when you look at the matchup, you'd love this game to be played in optimal conditions on some level to see these two teams on full display. The great part about it is regardless of what we get tonight and how Mother Nature elects to impact this football game, these two teams will run it back in a few short weeks in New England. So when you looked at the schedule before the season, I think a lot of people believed that it was going to be Miami potentially breathing down the neck of the Buffalo Bills, but suddenly it is indeed the New England Patriots. And all the narrative coming into this game is about how New England has a chance to be the number one seed. You have to think that that's not lost on a Buffalo team that finally got that Patriot monkey off their back last season, and we'll see what they can bring to the table tonight with so much on the line.
Yes. Did you just throw a jab at the Dolphins? They're coming on hot.
They are six and seven, bye week, chance to get to 7-7 against the Jets, and suddenly we might be talking about the Dolphins getting into this year's postseason instead of being on the outside looking in like we saw a season ago.
Man, the AFC is going to be wild. A lot of teams fighting for playoff contention. It's going to be a fun season down the stretch here.
Definition of a muddled mess when you look at the back half of that AFC playoff picture. The NFC, we at least have a pretty good idea of who the top teams will be. Still a lot to be sorted out in terms of seed 6-7, etc. All right, my friend. Big Monday Night Football game. Should be a lot of fun to watch. I know you're going to be extremely crestfallen and disappointed that we don't get to do this again on Wednesday with college football.
How will I survive?
I'm beginning to wonder. So, I just want to make sure that you're going to be okay with all that. But at least we finished the college football regular season with a win, made everybody sweat a little bit with that Houston team total. And of course, pulled off the double-double with the Washington football team winning outright. And you told our listeners that, hey, look, take the three or buy it up to three, lay the price at a minus $1.25, the number's going to come down, and it sure did, closing in that one range. So able to get there even if the Raiders are able to kick a field goal on their final possession. So a good weekend overall for our Bet the Board family.
Yeah, it was a good way to close out the college football season. I have to tell you, though, that should have been substantially easier. 13 points late in that game. That last touchdown drive for Houston was ridiculous. They got stopped, they're off the field, and then some phantom-like taunting penalty, which gave them a first down and kept the drive alive. And then Houston threw the ball behind the line of scrimmage on 3rd and 14 and somehow picked up 60. And then the 3rd and goal from the 8 touchdown. That should have been substantially easier.
Pretty much
for
a,
us with Houston.
Pretty much a give-up drive from Dana Holgorsen down 35-13. And lo and behold, like you said, some blown tackles and everything else. But hey, it pays just the same. Would have liked it to be more of a rocking chair, but a winner nonetheless. Any final words of wisdom, parting shots, things you would like to share before we get to do this all again on Thursday for NFL Week 14?
No, let's get out of here. We ran a little long for a Monday.
All right. It happens from time to time. For Pain Insider, follow him on Twitter at Pain Insider. I'm Todd Furman. Follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. FanDuel.com/BetTheBoard. 30-1 enhanced odds. Monday Night Football. Best of luck with all of your investments this fine evening, and hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.